back to Shavrimas. As I had promised, we're going to transition to a prophetic presentation from Yahweh. Yahweh happens to be God. He spoke through his prophet named Yashayah, which means salvation is from Yahweh. It's the only book that our scroll in actuality that we have completely intact from the Qumran collection. There are many Isaiah scrolls in the Qumran Dead Sea collections, but one of them in particular is complete. It's the only book which we have the entirety of it from beginning to end, dating to around 200 BCE, almost 2,200 years ago. The book was actually inspired around 750 BCE. The world was a very different place, and we're going to talk about what it was like at the time this was committed to paper. The book covers much of human history from the perspective of Israel, and in two chapters, after establishing Satan's affiliation with Babylon, and not so much the country as what Babylon represents in terms of religious and political military corruption. Now, God gets into a series of events that disclose what the last days here on earth are going to be like. And one of them begins in the 17th chapter of Yashayah and goes into the 18th. It is a depiction of Damascus falling, of the Syrian government failing, and of Israel being thinned at the waist as the United States is brokering this land for peace accord following that. And then an avalanche, a tidal wave, if you will, of Islamic terrorism, just as World War II followed the concession of the high ground of Czechoslovakia. God is telling us that World War III is going to begin, the first phase being the an all-Islamic assault against Israel, a terrorist assault that's going to be devastating in its consequences. God then tells us that he's going to intervene to stop it. But before this terrorist assault occurs, and after the peace treaty thins Israel, making it vulnerable, God's going to speak of a gleaning. That's a lakot. This particular chapter that I'm going to share with you is not published yet on Yada Yah or on an introduction to God or anywhere. It's a new chapter. It'll be published shortly, but I wanted to share it with you because it's like reading out of today's newspaper. I want to share it with you because it speaks of America. It speaks of Israel and this land for peace deal. It speaks of what's currently transpiring in Damascus and in Syria and the proxy war. It talks about how we can, how that war is going to end and what the consequences are going to be. And, of course, it speaks expressly of America and in very unflattering terms. So, if you're interested in what the next 10 to 15 years is going to bring, this is a powerful tool. It's like reading today's and tomorrow's newspaper all at the same time. So we're going to spend the time to go through the 17th and 18th chapter of Yashayah. It's called Lakot. It's called a gleaning. It presents so much useful information. And then after we're completed with that, and you know the landscape in terms of how the countries are going to interact and what's going to happen, we're going to transition into Questioning Paul. Many of you know that at questioningpaul.com we have finally published a year-long edit of that book. It went from about 600 pages to about 1,200 pages. And it is a comprehensive review of Pauline doctrine, of Paul's letters, particularly his first letter, his foundational letter, the epistle to the Galatians, called Galatians. But weaves in much of what Paul said in his letters to the Corinthians in Corinth, to Thessalonica, thus Thessalonians, to the Ephesians in Ephesus, to his lover Timothy, and of course to the Romans. And in that analysis of Paul's letters, we're going to compare what he said to what God said. Now, Paul, in essence, claims that he was inspired by God to contradict him, to oppose him, to besmirch him, to effectively call God and his testimony impotent. He even uses the basis of the English word for pornography to describe his view of God's testimony. Now, of course, it seems rather odd that anyone would believe that the God who provided all of this literature to us in the Torah and prophets would inspire someone to contradict him. But nevertheless, that's what Paul does and what Paul claims. So we're going to spend months systematically going through Paul's letters. And the reason we're going to do that is the religion of Christianity is based entirely on them. I know Christians claim that their religion is based upon Jesus Christ, but there was no Jesus Christ. There was a Messiah Yahusha, but he bears no resemblance to the Christian Jesus Christ. And Christians pay no attention to what Yahusha said. In fact, his testimony and his life are in direct contradiction to their religion. The only informed and rational conclusion that can be made is that Christianity is based on the letters that Paul wrote. And what he wrote is, well, at least should be questioned. And so we're going to do that because the world's most popular religion is based upon those 13 epistles. Tau for Lakot. It's named a gleaning. It speaks of Yisrael's fate and the fate of the covenant's children. The byline is, it's a time to leave. Millions of Christians have been beguiled into believing that the promises God made to the people they call Jews have somehow been transferred to their church. Many even believe that America was founded as a Christian nation and that thus uniquely was blessed by God as part of his transfer of allegiance to them. So convinced are American Christians that they are the apple of God's eye, most believe there must be biblical prophecies pertaining to their ultimate triumph. As evidence of this, the American conceived and 20 million strong Church of Seventh-day Adventist was born out of Ellen White's prophecies regarding this impending victory and their role in it. And among American evangelical Christians, no topic is more appealing than their role in eschatology. This is borne out by the popularity of the Left Behind series of religious novels. Even Mormonism, with 6 million American members, bears this stain. Deceived into believing that Jews abandoned Israel and sailed to the New World several thousand years ago, becoming the native peoples, this American religion of Latter-day Saints is predicated upon replacement theology. Even politically, the myth that devout Christians immigrated from Europe to America for religious freedom, thus creating a Christian nation, belies the realization that many were more savage than any of the native peoples whose land they stole. And this American propensity to confiscate land which belongs to others will loom very large in what follows. We have discovered through Yahweh's witness that God remains steadfastly and eternally focused on Yisrael. He only mentions other nations when they interact with his land and his chosen people, most often using the occasion to expose and condemn the choices and behaviors of Gentiles in this regard. And it is in this vein that there may be a prediction. In fact, I can say there is a prediction which specifically identifies America, albeit in the midst of a horrible storm and in a very unflattering manner. But this event, if true, then the United States is implicated because it has armed the Muslims who will besiege Israel. And worse, has sought to give the land of Israel to its enemies. In essence, the U.S. is attempting to repeat the mistakes of Neville Chamberlain when the leader of Great Britain lit the fire that became World War II, sacrificing Czechoslovakia to the Nazis in the name of peace. But my friends, God doesn't care about Czechoslovakia. He doesn't care about Great Britain. He doesn't care about America, but he does care about Israel. And so those nations like America that would sacrifice, carve out Israeli land that God gave to his people and give it to their avowed enemies, God is enraged against such a country. And that country is America. If you're a patriotic American, engaged in politics, supporting your military, you're going to find that God himself warned you against doing these things, against being associated with this country's behavior. It's a sobering announcement for those who remain patriotic and political in this country, for those who remain religious in this country, for those who bellow out God bless America in this country. Since Yahweh's portrayal of the United States is so unflattering, before we analyze it, be cognizant of the fact that Christians, like most Israelites today, are estranged from Yahweh because they have consistently chosen religion over relationship and the doctrines of men over the teachings of God. This reality is presented in the Going Astray volume of Yad Yah, should you be curious, which compares Hosha's Yisrael to today's America and indeed most of the West. The reason that those living in the United States are doomed, and many are damned, is because the religious, political, military, economic, societal, media, and academic agendas of this nation in particular are misleading, and they are counterproductive. The Western world's leaders have a scarred conscience. They, in turn, have sought to destroy their people's ability to exercise good judgment. And they have achieved this condition through the imposition of political correctness, an amoral code that negates rational thought. More on this when we return after the commercial break. The imposition of what we call political correctness is devastating because it is in opposition to the exercise of good judgment. Without good judgment, it doesn't matter how much a person knows, because they're rendered incapable of understanding. It's why so many Americans blabber on about this notion that we're a force for good in the world, that we're standing on the right side, that democracy is the ultimate good for the world. We lack context. We lack the inability or the ability to understand the situations that we're talking about. We never seem to understand the consequence of our actions, how, for example, the invasion of Iraq was based on a series of lies, and that rather than making the situation better in a war on terrorism, it exacerbated terrorism egregiously and made the world vastly more vulnerable, ultimately leading to the proxy war known as the Syrian Civil War, which is then going to spread around the world. We just don't exercise good judgment. And with political correctness, we're amoral, incapable of exercising moral restraint, making moral choices. Ultimately, the imposition in our educational institutions of political correctness negates the benefits of free will. The imposition of political correctness thereby makes the masses much easier to manipulate, to mislead, to control, and, of course, inflates. Without accurate information or the ability to evaluate it, freedom becomes irrelevant. It's the story of 1984. It's the story of A Brave New World. It's the story of Animal Farm. People willingly choose to give up their freedoms. It's what happened in Nazi Germany when Hitler was popularly elected. It's what's happening around the world. When the ability to choose wisely is obfuscated by either ignorance or irrationality, people become like domesticated animals, incapable of knowing God or discerning right from wrong. They are easily prodded and thus corralled and controlled. Societies degrade as a result. A condition that is ripe for the imposition of dictatorships. The people become ever more dependent on their government. Terror and carnality ultimately rule as a result. Chaos follows. Because those who neither know nor understand are prone to obey those in positions of authority and then ultimately explode with anger. In the past, Catholic, Muslim, and communist-controlled societies have used a common ploy to negate free will and thus to manipulate the masses. They have withheld information through censorship. Such nations are known for their tyrannical control over the media and for indoctrination and propaganda. And those who dared reveal the truth in such nations paid the ultimate price. Accurate information was so lethal to those who were empowered, they eliminated the resources and the sources of such information. But when the printing press and later the internet arrived, keeping the masses ignorant became especially difficult. Recognizing this problem, Adam Weishaupt, the founder of socialist secular humanism, conceived as part of his religion of enlightenment in post-Reformation Europe a new moral code, which made exercising good judgment a crime. So as information became ubiquitous, mankind was trained to disregard, even disdain, anything that was in conflict with what would become known as politically correct. Schools, once places that encouraged logical decision-making, rendered their victims incapable of it. Political correctness thereby enabled elitists to establish the foundation for their desired master-slave New World Order by turning people into sheeple. Weishaupt's new moral code ultimately rendered being judgmental, being discerning and discriminating, even being rational and moral a crime against humanity. If you speak morally today about homosexuality, you'll see what I mean. Yes, now, being against that which is politically correct is an act so vile, there is no defense, even truth. You see, truth would no longer be relevant. Logic would no longer matter. Evidence and reason would be rejected in favor of the universal good. From this perspective, and from this point on, no matter how irrational, all options, all cultures, every religion and political system, even the most abnormal behaviors were accepted, even respected, regardless of how contradictory, how errant, how immoral, or worse, how overtly destructive and deadly they may be. In the world of political correctness, there would be no right and wrong, no heaven or hell. So even with all of the world's knowledge at one's fingertips, it would no longer do anyone any good because they lost the ability to be circumspect. Back in a moment. The imposition nationally of political correctness, this fact that the religion of socialist secular humanism has been imposed on Americans, with the U.S. judiciary becoming the judges, becoming the priests of political correctness, with the propaganda arm, the indoctrination arm being America's educational establishments, with the those leading the parades being politicians and the media playing such a promotional marketing role of political correctness. It is universally accepted in America. It is the de facto moral standard of America. You know, who would have thought that a nation whose First Amendment decries the lack of an imposition of a national religion, that says people ought to be free. Now, I happen to disagree. I think people ought to be free to choose whatever religion they want, but there are some religions that are so counter to human security that they that the practice of which is criminal, and they need to be disallowed, for example, Islam. But here with the free practice of religion, what we found is that in America, judges now say that's not true. You can only freely practice socialist secular humanism. Political correctness, and what it states is the only religion that you are free to practice. All other religions will be infringed upon. This, as much as anything, is the reason America is depicted, I think, so negatively by Yahweh. No matter how many religions and religious and political lies are exposed and condemned, America's collective nesama, or conscience, has been so badly scarred, has become so unexercised and flabby, the truth no longer does any good. Hope is now only personal and individual. There is no salvation for the nation as a whole. This is true of so many countries around the world. According to Yahweh, the overwhelming preponderance of people will miss the harvest, the Christian faithful errantly call the rapture. They will be left behind. But this will not occur in a vacuum. No, nor have we been left unaware. Through his prophet, Yahshua, salvation is from Yahweh. God has revealed one of the most profound, detailed, pertinent, and devastating prophecies pertaining to our time. It is one that would have been difficult, if not impossible, to ascertain a generation ago, prior to the playing out of world events as they were predicted so very long ago. The prophetic book that is named Salvation is from Yahweh and misnamed Isaiah is compiled both topically and chronologically. It opens declaring that Israel will continue to be religious and thus rebellious, at least until the last possible moment. In his review of relevant future history, Yahweh focuses on the role his set-apart spirit and his most set-apart and diminished corporeal manifestation will play in fulfilling the promises that he has made to all of us. Called Yahusha, Yahweh saves, Emmanuel, God with us, Ha-Ben, the Son, El, God Almighty, Ha-Sur, Yasha, the rock of our salvation, and Ha-Masiyah, the work of Yahweh. These titles all portray the means Yahweh has and continues to deploy to enable the benefits of his covenant. In fact, in this particular presentation, he's going to use the term Zeruah, which is the sacrificial lamb of God, and going to say that his Zeruah, his sacrificial lamb, is going to carry his children home, keeping them out of a terrible, vexing time of tribulation. Specifically, Yahweh, through Yahusha and the set-apart spirit, has fulfilled the first four mikrei, these invitations to be called out and to meet with God. He did so in year 4000 Yah, which was 33 CE. His return will occur in year 6000 Yah, 2033, when he will fulfill the promises of reconciliations and tabernacles. And at that time, in the midst of his prophetic eyewitness account of the most important days of all of human history, through his prophet, Yahweh predicted that a remnant of Yisrael and Yahuda would return to him. They would embrace his name, his Torah, and his covenant during the last days. The vine which is Yisrael will bear fruit again. The covenant will be restored. Yahweh's sixth and seventh appearances were predicted in the awe-inspiring language of the ninth chapter of Yahshua, at a time that Assyria was predicted to be the implement used to chastise Yisrael for the northern kingdom's infidelity. By the 11th chapter, the prophet returned to the cure, the spirit of Yahweh. But since there is an adversarial spirit, so the 13th and 14th chapter explain the actual nature of Ha-Satan, the adversary, revealing his most enduring deceptions. the political and religious schemes that were born and bred in Babylon. The adversary is introduced by name for the first time. He is Hillel ben Shakar, a fallen messenger whose ambition is to be worshipped as the Lord God. With the stage set, the players identified, Yeshayah was inspired to chronicle the fate of nations. This begins in the 15th and 16th chapters with depictions of Moab, which is Jordan. The destiny of this Islamic country is not encouraging because fundamentalist jihadi Muslims despise Jordan for its willingness to negotiate with their most hated enemy and for being a secular state. Therefore, on their way to destroy the Zionists, they have been indoctrinated into despising these Jordanians. And these Islamic mujahideens will trample Jordan underfoot, according to the prophecy, leaving death and destruction, desolation in their wake. And while that is what the prophecy reveals, the propensity of Muslims to abuse Muslims is so poorly understood in the West, this predictive testimony may not seem credible to some, at least prior to the carnage the world is witnessing now in Syria. But I can tell you that after having compiled a 1,400-year history of Muslim malfeasance, which is chronicled in the Islamic Terrorist Timeline, which is available at prophetofdoom.net, I have come to appreciate why Jordan can opt out of what's going to be the Magog War against Israel, an all-Islamic war against Israel, and still be destroyed, not by Yahweh or by Jews, Yehudim, but by fellow Muslims. This inhospitable tendency of Muslims to abuse, to rape, to terrorize, and to murder their brethren in mass was first predicted in the Torah. A messenger of Yahweh, speaking of Ishmael's descendants, was sent to convey the following assessment. Then the messenger of Yahweh said to her, this was Hagar, Ishmael's mother, massively numerous will be his offspring, too numerous to count. So the messenger of Yahweh said to her, pay attention to this. You're pregnant with a son. Call his name Ishmael. Indeed, Yahweh has heard of your affliction, your poverty and misery, your prostrate and wretched nature and utter dependency. Therefore, he shall actually and continuously be a wild ass of a man. His hand will be against everyone, and everyone's hand will be against him. Also, in opposition to the presence of all of his brothers, he will continue to live. This is evident today in Syria, where Sunni jihadists are at the throats of Shiites. But it is also pervasive in every Islamic country. Even if the entire world were to submit to Islam, the carnage would continue unabated. The Syrian war is currently the world's bloodiest, with the death toll now over 130,000 and climbing rapidly. There is no end in sight, and that is because it is actually a proxy war, whereby Sunni fiefdoms of Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, and Qatar, in league with Turkey, Europe, and the United States, are arming mujahideen in a desperate attempt to stem the rising tide of Iranian Shiite influence in the Middle East, with nations drawing red lines in these shifting sands. Russia and China, as a result of their desire to retain their pipeline access to the massive Caspian Sea oil and gas reserves, are on the other side, siding with Iran and thus Syria. It is the one conflict in the past 50 years that has the potential of combusting into a global firestorm. The catalyst for this war was the misguided and counterproductive American invasion of Iraq, whereby the United States deposed a secular dictator and replaced him with a puppet government, one controlled entirely by the government, by the Grand Ayatollah, I should say, Ayatollah al-Sistani. He is an Iranian mullah. It effectively gave Iraq to Iran. With the gift of their former enemy, Iran's influence in the region surged, and through their militia Hezbollah, which means Allah's party, the Shiites in Tehran have gained control over Syria and over Lebanon, along with absolute control over Iraq. It provides them with direct access to Israel, the nation they have publicly vowed to destroy. In these events, we are witnessing the preamble to World War III, a war which is currently being throttled by events in Damascus, where Sunni Mujahideen are killing fellow Sunnis as readily as Shia. These realizations explain why Yahweh chose to commence this prophecy regarding the impending Islamic assault against Israel as a result of America's meddling throughout the Middle East, and especially in Israel, with a reference to Damascus, the capital of Syria, and the site of the world's worst infighting. In theory, the siege of the city by Sunni Mujahideen is designed to unify Islam and to reestablish an Islamic caliphate. This, these same Muslims hope, will serve as the triggering mechanism for the final Islamic conquest of the world. We'll continue this story after the commercial break. What Americans don't seem to recognize is that not only did they start the Syrian civil war, something that God has not lost sight of, by empowering Iran and Shiite Islam over Sunni Islam, giving Iraq to Iran, enabling Iran to complete its nuclear ambitions. Not only did they do that, but they armed both sides in this battle. And that the principal purpose of the hundreds of thousands of Sunni Mujahideen, Islamic jihadists, that are fighting in the proxy war in Syria, is that, talk to any of them, they all say exactly the same thing. They wish to establish Sharia law, not only in Syria, but throughout the world. And they recognize that it was out of Damascus, Syria, that the last caliphate held sway. And that for many hundreds of years, Islam ruled much of the world out of Damascus, Syria. They want to reestablish that caliphate as the base for Muslims first to attack Israel and then to get the rest of the world to surrender to Islam. What the world doesn't seem to recognize as well is that by empowering the Sunnis, as America is doing, with weapons in this battle, and having started it by providing weapons to the Sunni warlords in Iraq, that what ultimately is going to happen is that the Sunnis will prevail. They outband the Shias 4-1. Shia Islam represents 20% of Islam worldwide, and Sunni Islam represents 80% of Muslims worldwide. So the Shiites are outmanned 4-1. But they're outgunned by more than 10-1. The Sunni Islamic fiefdoms and nations outspend the Shia nations by 10-1 in terms of annual military budgets. So in the range of $15 billion to $150 billion. So they're outgunned 10-1. They're outmanned 4-1. The Sunnis are going to prevail. Now, right now, they aren't. Right now, Assad has the upper hand. Hugely, strongly, convincingly. And most recently, the Sunni Mujahideen have been killing their fellow Sunni Mujahideen. So, you know, if you were just to look at the way the events are playing out currently, you'd predict Assad to prevail. But that's not what the prophecy says. The prophecy says that the Sunnis will prevail, that Damascus will be destroyed, and that the government out of Damascus and Syria will fall as a nation. Now, what America doesn't want to recognize, or seems incapable of recognizing, which is why I went into this whole dissertation on political correctness, and it's destroying our ability to think rationally, is what happened the last time we played this game. The last time America armed Islamic jihadists and told them to go fight a proxy war against an enemy was in first Afghanistan. Now, not only were a couple of million Afghanis killed by Jimmy Carter's and Zbigniew Brzezinski's ill-fated attempt to fight a proxy war against the Soviet Union in Afghanistan. Once the Mujahideen with American weapons and backing prevailed, once the Taliban and Al-Qaeda destroyed the Soviet claim to Afghanistan, what did they do? Did those jihadists that America's armed and funded just simply settle in Afghanistan and say, oh, we've created such a wonderful country here, I think I'll stay. I think I'll become an opium farmer. Did they say, I think we'll just hunker on down here with the Taliban and stone some women to death? Or did they go back to their countries? Is it just like Syria, where jihadists are being recruited from all around the Islamic world and equipped with American weapons and funded by America through its proxies? Did they go back home? They did, didn't they? And what happened over the next decade after they prevailed as jihadists, as terrorists, over the Soviet-backed government? When they got really good at killing, they went back to their countries and they began to kill there. The terrible train bombings and bus station bombings throughout Europe, 9/11 in the United States, the embassy bombings in Africa, were all a result of the ill-fated attempt to start a proxy war with Muslims.